This is Karen Lyle of SailSport Talk with Christopher Kane, and we are talking about the oldest race and the newest race, America's Cup and SailGP.
I think it's really interesting, and I think we all saw this when the America's Cup was in San Francisco. This curiosity about whether you could take a very old event like the America's Cup and actually create a made-for-television spectacle, one that fans would engage with. And for every Russell Coutts who believes that this is the future of the sport, there is a Grant Dalton from New Zealand who believed that this was never going to be a mass-market televised sport. And I think kind of that split in where does the America's Cup go? How does this become more than this niche race, which we sailors love? And I think in the America's Cup in New Zealand, and I think in SailGP, which is going to roll into San Francisco in a couple months, I think you're seeing the purest expressions right now of those two directions the Cup could go in.
Well, and with SailGP, what they did was they set up a spectator zone between the St. Francis Yacht Club and the Golden Gate Yacht Club with bleachers and all of the paraphernalia of a stadium. And there were spectators there, but we still had the yacht clubs with their private events. So it was a combination of both.
Well, I mean, I see that in sports. You got your fans in the stands. You got your VIPs in the suites, you know, and it's great the way they did it. Like many new sports or new activities, you tend to first kind of ape what came before. So we're going to make this look like a baseball game. We're going to make this look like a football game. I'm not sure necessarily that's the correct way to go forward. I think there's a more organic way you can do it. You know, the majority of the fans wound up just hanging out on the shores. I think you'd have some fun with that. But I think you learn this when you're creating any kind of new event is first you kind of adopt to what has been done before, and then you figure out what your relationship is with a fan and how best to deliver that experience. And I think the America's Cup proper sort of has their way of doing things. And I think CLGP is figuring out right now what this relationship is to their fan. And in terms of channels, I mean, live and online and through things like YouTube.
And now gaming.
And gaming now. I think they're going to keep testing and playing around with this. I don't think anybody knows the formula yet. But I feel like there is an opening there. And I think CLGP can really become something real.
Now, Christopher, is it about the boats or is it about the fans?
I think the America's Cup, as much as it's about the competition, it's also as much about the boats, the technology, what's going to work, what's not going to work. I think we're all fascinated what these new America's Cup boats, these AC-75s, are going to perform like in close quarters. I mean, gigantic keels that come out of the water like razor blades, and they're right at eye level.
This is Karen Lyle, and this was A Cup of Kane with Scotch on SailSport Talk.
All right, it's Tuesday in our first hour. Rick Tittle with you, and that means on Sports Byline that we have Karen Lyle, SailSportTalk.com host. How you doing, Karen?
I am doing fantastic.
Any sailing this weekend for you?
I did. I went out on President's Day and just sailed out my little heart out. Actually, I went at sunset.
Contiki to the Farallones?
You know, I could see the Farallones. It was pretty amazing. No green flash, though. You know about the green flash, right?
No,
they're supposed to be when the sun comes down and you can see it right with the water, this little green flash on the water.
Wow.
I didn't see any green flash.
Well, that's the nickname of our guest, Gary Green, the Green Flash. He is with us because he is a sailor who's been through a lot. He has years and years of experience. He's been the Commodore of the Southern California Yachting Association. Recently had a bit of peril in which he needed rescuing. Gary, you ever been called the Green Flash?
No, the name of the boat was Green Dragon.
Very good. Now, what happened with this recent rescue?
Okay, well, to give you some background, we were on our way from La Paz to Mazatlan, which requires crossing the Sea of Cortez, a passage of approximately 200 nautical miles. We needed a three-day weather window to complete the voyage. The first day was uneventful. The second day, which was January 1st, New Year's Day, a storm came up. The storm involved waves 2 to 3 meters. It's about 6 to 9 feet plus. And the waves are very closely spaced together, so one after the next. And we noticed around 5 o'clock that day that we were taking on water. Below, my wife searched down below to look through all the through holes. Those are valves that let water in from the hull for different purposes, like flushing and water supply. They were all closed. I took a look myself. I could not find the source of the water. The water kept rising until the floorboards down below were awash, and the floorboards actually floated up. And at one point, the water was about 4 feet deep inside the cabin.
Whoa.
At that point, I announced on radio a mayday. That is a distress call of the highest order. I also hailed the Mexican Navy, or Armada Mexicana in Spanish. They did not respond. Fortunately, another cruising sailboat, which was about 24 nautical miles south of us, did respond. We were at the very edge of VHF radio reception, which is line of sight. This other boat was called the sailing vessel Hajime. At that point, was quite a distance away from us. So they proceeded to our location. It took them 5 hours to arrive at our location. In the meanwhile, the water kept rising. We had, of course, the bilge pumps on, but could not determine the source of the water. So knowing that the rescuing vessel was approaching, we realized that they could not just come alongside us because the seas were very high, at least 6 feet plus. So we launched our life raft.
And for a moment, Gary, let's talk a little bit about the life raft. So,
sure.
So the life raft is something that, you know, anytime you're out there on the ocean, it's a good thing to have because it protects you on all sides. What was it like for you at the moment that you knew that you're going to lose your vessel and you're boarding that life raft in those high seas?
Well, there was a lot of time, preparation time leading up to that realization. We went down below the cabin multiple times to retrieve passports, ship's papers, and other valuables. Each time was very difficult to move around in a flooded cabin with all the floorboards swirling around and all the debris. We deployed the life raft, which is in a valise, a canvas cover, by first attaching the painter, that's the line that holds it to the boat, around a winch. And that enabled us to pull the life raft close to the stern of our boat where we have a swim step to make boarding easier. We deployed the life raft and then winched it close to the stern of our boat so we could just step on board. In the meanwhile, we were making repeated trips down below to retrieve our valuables and papers. We initially put them in what's called a ditch bag. That's a canvas bag that carries water and food for use in a life raft. But we quickly realized that the ditch bag was going to be far too heavy to heave up onto the deck of a rescuing boat. So instead, we took our valuables and papers, put them in a smaller bag, and that's what we used to transfer to the rescuing boat. We did not actually enter the life raft until the rescuing boat was on scene. At that point, I basically just jumped into the raft, tumbled, but was unhurt because the floor is kind of soft. Raft is basically an inflatable raft, which was stored, as I said, in a valise. It could also be stored in a fiberglass container. And it's inflated by usually carbon dioxide gas in a cylinder. And it inflates very rapidly. And it basically had two circular inflation tubes surrounding it and a floor and also an inflatable arch which supports a fabric canopy for protection from the elements. So I realized that we could not let the raft drift far enough to reach the rescuing boat, which was standing off our stern. So I tied a second line between the raft and my boat, which was then sinking, And my wife jumped in, and I took a knife and cut the painter. That's the line again, connecting the life raft with my boat. And since we had the second longer line, we drifted backwards under control. But we did not drift back still far enough, because the rescuing boat had to stay at least 100 feet away to avoid colliding with our boat. So I brought with me a heaving rope, which, as the word explains, is simply a rope in a bag that you could throw quite a distance, like at least 50, 75 feet. So after several tries, people on the rescuing boat were able to catch the heaving line, and then we both pulled each other toward their boat. So the raft is now up alongside the hull of the rescuing boat. And then they had to pull me forward to their ladder, which was located amidships in the middle of their boat.
Gary, just let me for a moment just paint this picture. So you have 6 to 9 foot waves, swells that you're dealing with. And so what were the intervals of those waves, and how did that play into trying to get from one boat to the other?
The interval was pretty short. I'd say maybe 3 to 5 seconds. It'd be another. So that was physically quite a challenge. That was the primary reason that the rescuing boat could not just come alongside us. The raft is considerably lower than the freeboard of the deck of the rescuing boat, so the only way to get up was on a ladder. So it made it very challenging, because the raft is going up and down in relation to the rescuing boat. So I was also the entrance to the raft was located about 90 degrees to the ladder. So I had to basically twist myself around, climbed up the ladder. At that point, my wife threw the small ditch bag, which contained her valuables. But then at that point, we lost control of that heaving line, which was the only thing holding the raft close to the rescuing boat. So the rescuing boat then had no steerage way, no ability to maneuver. So they had to put their engine in gear, and they made a pass around. And then the man who was the skipper of that boat had his own heaving line ready to go, and he threw it. Unfortunately, it landed right in the entrance of the raft, and my wife was able to grab it. And then they pulled her the same way as they did me within the raft alongside their boat until the point where she could reach the ladder. She had difficulty getting her foot on the lower ladder rung, which, again, because of these waves, it makes it very difficult.
It sounds very perilous. Just a couple minutes left with Gary Green. Gary, did you ever discover the reason why your ship went down?
No, I did not. I was able to rule out certain sources. The through hull was fine. The steering was fine. There had been no collision. No knockdown, but that unfortunately is going to probably remain unknown, since the boat is presumed sunk in over 340 feet of water, 80 miles offshore of Mazatlan, Mexico. So I doubt we'll ever know for sure.
And Armada Mexicana, did they ever say sorry, or did they have? Is that like their Coast Guard as well, their Navy?
Yes, the Mexican Navy has a Coast Guard unit. They don't have a separate Coast Guard service like we do. But no, they never contacted me. They never responded on the radio. They actually made my situation worse by reporting to the U.S. Coast Guard that they were on scene, when in reality they had responded to a totally separate boat miles away. And that other boat reportedly did not need evacuation, but merely an escort into shore. So they did not contact me and gave inaccurate information to the U.S. Coast Guard. Fortunately, the cruising sailboat that rescued us kept on going and effected the rescue.
Well, that was a marvelous rescue that they did, and I had a chance to read about the account that the boat owner who picked you up had in Latitude 38, and also your account as well, Latitude 38 being a sailor's magazine that's located here in Northern California and available around the world. Gary, you also are a past Commodore of the Southern California Yachting Association. How many yacht clubs are in that association?
We have over 90 clubs, and they're predominantly in Southern California. We also have member clubs located in Arizona and Nevada, and we even have one member in Ensenada, Mexico. So it's quite a number of clubs. We have monthly meetings. We put on a lot of seminars, educational seminars, which are open to the public. And we put on one of the largest regattas in North America, which is called the Midwinter Regatta, which is just completed. We have over 600 boats participating at 25 different venues up and down the coast.
There he is, Gary Green. Gary, I'm glad everything worked out for you. Thanks for being a guest on the show, and we hope to catch up with you down the road.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary.
And we got about a minute here, Karen. What was your most perilous moment in sea that you can give us in a minute?
You know, it was in a small boat, but it wasn't really perilous. We were in my dad and I were traveling back in the Delta to his boat on a Boston Whaler. It was about 10 feet. And those boats are not supposed to sink. But what really happens when you get flooded from the back and you've got, you know, 3 or 4 foot of chop and it's coming from behind you is that the boat just kind of rests under the water, so you're standing waist high in water with the boat kind of there. And we just, you know, kind of basically I swam to shore, pulled it to shore. We sat on the rocks, and my dad and I had a great conversation on the shore. It was actually one of those special moments, but I don't think it was perilous.
Well, that's good. I hope that's as bad as it gets for you.
All right.
Thanks for coming in. We'll see you next week.
Okay.
I'm Rick Tittle. Come on back.